Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We know that polar ice will continue to retreat and seas will rise for thousands of years. Should we expect the ocean to release more carbon dioxide for millennia?
I mean, we've just published a study about the ocean sink in the Arctic, and that was actually a very interesting exercise because we found that the CO2 uptake in the Arctic accelerates a lot because of the declining sea ice, pretty much just because the ocean surface becomes exposed to the atmosphere and can therefore take up CO2. So that was quite surprising how strong that effect in the Arctic actually is because of the declining sea ice. So yes, indeed, the sea ice melting plays also a quite important role for the ocean CO2 uptake. Directly because it exposes the ocean surface to the atmosphere, but also indirect because it can have a very strong impact on the ocean circulation.
So the carbon capture by the ocean, if humans keep heating everything up, do we clearly understand what will happen, or are there still some mysteries to be solved?
No, I don't think that we have understood everything. I mean, in particular, as I just mentioned, there are relatively large uncertainties about how the ocean circulation will evolve. Also have direct implications about uncertainties in predicting the ocean carbon sink. But on top of that, there are, I guess, other important processes that we haven't fully understood because they are extremely complex to model and therefore extremely hard to predict into the future. And these are, for example, changes in ocean biology. I'm thinking here, for example, about the biological carbon pump that is also important for transporting CO2 that is photosynthetically fixed at the ocean surface into the deep ocean. But I guess the really most important element when it comes to predicting how the ocean carbon sink will behave in the future are our emissions, and that we have, of course, in our own hands. So ideally, we would reduce the ocean carbon sink by drastically reducing our CO2 emissions into the atmosphere.
And where do you see your own research going?
So I just finished my postdoc at ETH, where I was working in the environmental physics group led by Nicolas Gruber. And I just started a research fellowship at the U.S. nonprofit organization Carbon2C. And here we are launching the first model intercomparison project for what's called ocean alkalinity enhancement. The idea here is that one could potentially enhance the ocean CO2 uptake by making the ocean more alkaline. We have previously talked about the fact that as the ocean gets more acidic, the ocean carbon uptake efficiency will decline, and we could, in essence, reverse this process by making the ocean more alkaline. And at the moment, there are a lot of individual modeling studies done all over the world. Some people even started to do field experiments to really make the ocean more alkaline, for example, by spreading ground limestone over the ocean. But what's missing at the moment is that we are, for example, with respect to modeling experiments, really combining our efforts and making the model simulations comparable across the many participating modeling centers all over the world. And that will be my new role here to, as I said, coordinate this first global model intercomparison project for ocean alkalinity enhancement at Carbon2C.
From Zurich and the NGO Carbon2C, we have been speaking with Dr. Jens Daniel Müller. He led the new paper in Nature, Unexpected Decline in Ocean Carbon Sink Under Record High Sea Surface Temperatures in 2023. You can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jens, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you very much, Alex. It was a great pleasure to talk to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
the methane emergency brake.
As you probably know, end of September was Climate Week in New York City. It was a super gathering of world experts buzzing like bees about the emerging climate emergency. The NGO Methane Action gathered some of the best to talk about methane. Can we control that super warming gas, which is responsible for almost a third of warming on this planet? Host Daphne Washam called on the president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, Durwood Zelke. Sadly, the audio is unintelligible to humans, but sort of worrisome. Google AI got it all pretty well right in a transcript. So I'm going to read Durwood Zelke's initial remarks. It's a bit long, but I think it's worth it. Let's give it a go. Durwood says, "It's very simple. It's too hot. Yeah, we're 1.5 degrees. The latest IPCC report says we're headed to 3 degrees, and we have too little time before the self-amplifying feedbacks push us past a series of tipping points. There are 5 to 11 irreversible tipping points between 1.5 and 2 degrees. So 1.5 today, 2 tomorrow, 3 soon after, I mean, we are in a climate emergency. So we need the strategies that are the fastest way to turn warming. It should be obvious, but we originally, those of us who worked on this for decades, you know, thought that the climate might be a long-term problem. You know, we figure this out in the future. But the moment is now that we need to bend the warming curve. So you look at the strategies, you look at the decarbonization side, which is absolutely essential, and we need to move to clean energy as fast as we possibly can. But you discover that is not the best way to turn down warming. It is a long-term marathon, and that's because it is politically difficult. But it is also because when you shut down fossil fuel facilities, especially coal, diesel, you shut down the coated cooling sulfates they emit, and those fall out in days to weeks, and they unmask existing warming. There was an op-ed this week in the New York Times pointing out the unmasking problem Jim Hansen refers to as the Faustian bargain. As we clean up the air, as we decarbonize, we are exposing existing warming. Now, the op-ed unfortunately came to the wrong conclusion for the solution. They said we should go first to geoengineered solutions. But that is not the first thing I put on the list for fast mitigation. Well, what would I put on the list? Decarbonization kicks in at around 2060, starts up fast, but it is a marathon. So the non-CO2, it is the sprint. Within that sprint, methane is the most important piece. And I just came from a meeting with the Climate and Clean Air Coalition that it was hosting. And every single minister and head of state there used the facts and figures from the Climate and Clean Air Coalition on methane. At least the staff wrote the right things for ministers. And I think some of the ministers really do get it. They see that thing is right. And so we're doing promises and pledges. These have been okay to get us going to socialize the issue, but it is no longer sufficient in a climate emergency to say promises. You have to have mandatory mitigation. So that's the direction it can be done, at the municipal level for waste. But it's got to be mandatory, to be done at the state level like California, at the national level, at the European level. End quote from Durwood Zilke at the Methane Emergency Break event, New York City, September 24, 2025. Human methane emissions could be dramatically reduced through changes in the natural gas industry and eventually the end of the natural gas industry. Farming and diets could change to slash methane. We can capture it at the dumps in many sources. We can't do much about the methane from thawing permafrost bogs, but even that would slow down with less human-made methane in the atmosphere. The good news, if we do it, methane already up there begins to break down in just 10 years. This is climate action where people could feel a tangible result in a pretty quick time. Find out more at methaneaction.org. But I want to get back to the emergency part, like a deadly climate shift in the next 25 years. A new paper this year is titled Earth's Energy Imbalance More Than Doubled in Recent Decades. I have invited the lead author for an interview, but for now, here are three key points from that study. 1. Earth's energy imbalance more than doubled in recent decades. 2. The large trend has taken us by surprise, and as a community, we should strive to understand the underlying causes. 3. Our capability to observe Earth's energy imbalance in budget terms is threatened as satellites are decommissioned. And that's an end quote from the paper, Earth's Energy Imbalance More Than Doubled in Recent Decades. Now, again, remember that retired NASA climate expert James Hansen has been shouting about Earth's energy imbalance ever since his 2011 paper, Earth's Energy Imbalance and Implications. What does it mean? Satellites and ground observatories can measure the amount of solar energy reaching Earth's surface, whether that is land, sea, or ice. Around 30% of that energy should bounce back into space, reflected by clouds, pollution, or any light surface below, like ice or snow. Satellites can also measure the amount of energy reflected from Earth, observed at the top of atmosphere. Records of those measurements show less solar energy is bouncing off the planet. Greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane are keeping that extra energy within the Earth system. James Hansen and others argue measurements of Earth energy imbalance accurately reflect climate change, better than calculations of the global average mean temperature, now used in all major scientific reports and governments and press and even in this show. It is a huge deal that Earth's energy imbalance more than doubled in recent decades. Huge. That pretty well proves that global warming is accelerating. It is. That is the reality. Sane people must struggle to comprehend that and then act.
It's 110 for a month or more. Can't go outside, hear the AC roar. It's like living in the pressure cooker, super hot corner. Turn up the gas and burn that oil in the pressure cooker.
Another sure sign of all this is accelerated sea level rise. Maps of abnormal ocean heat are everywhere. You've probably seen them. The marine heat wave in the North Pacific this year lasted at least half a year. A group of Chinese scientists published an extraordinary study recently. The title is Accelerated Ocean Thermal Expansion and Its Contribution to Global Sea Level Rise. The author is Ting Yu Liang. It was published in the Journal of Sea Research June 3, 2025. We only have time now for the highlights. Quote, ocean heat content rose 1.7 times faster in the past decade than in previous decades. Thermal expansion accounted for 56% of global sea level rise in recent decades. Global mean sea level rose 1.8 times faster in the past decade than in previous decades. Since the 1990s, greenhouse gases have surpassed solar forcing in ocean warming. This is all astounding stuff. Seawater simply heating up that much pushed more sea level rise than melting glaciers. In the acceleration, greenhouse gases are warming the seas more than the sun. Heat in the sea is increasing faster. From winds to rains to what we eat, acceleration of ocean heat will change our lives in a thousand ways. For one thing, scientists already say excess heat in the ocean helped power up megastorms like Typhoon Ragasa, striking the Philippines, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and South China. Global warming may not bring more hurricanes, but those that do form can spin up into giants of tremendous wind powers in less than 24 hours, and they take additional energy from the hot seas below. It is only a matter of time until the next ahistoric storm strikes North America again. Accelerated ocean warming is here to accompany accelerated global warming. Scientists are freaking out. Anybody paying attention should be. Climate change will dominate politics, economy, and lives for hundreds and thousands of years. You and I, we are living in the big change, the end of one history, and the start of another completely new world. How many will live to see it? I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for your attention to this matter.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Outside my studio, it is another summer heat wave in fall. On a global map of abnormal heat, we are number one. I've seen snow on the ground in late September. We should need a wood fire at night, but nope, it's summer. Massive wildfires are burning south of us in Washington State. We get American smoke from time to time. What do these climate-hyped wildfires cost the economy? The Environmental Defense Fund ran a webinar called Wildfire, Costs of Inaction, and Opportunities to Close the Finance Gap. That was September 9th, 2025. I attended and recorded it. Here is a short estimate by Dr. Chris Costello. He is EDF's chief economist, a member of the Council of Economic Advisors for Governor Newsom, and professor of environmental economics, University of California, Santa Barbara.
Where I live here in the Western United States, you live here as well, wildfire is a natural part of the landscape. But as you know, a century of suppression has led to an ecosystem that's really completely out of whack. And I think we all know that climate change is exacerbating the imbalance, and really the costs of catastrophic wildfires are on the rise. I do research and advise on these issues, but I also see it firsthand. My family and I have had to evacuate our home several times in the last decade because of really close calls with wildfire. The costs are growing, but what are the costs? I mean, we're all familiar with things like property damage, insurance costs, suppression costs. Those are on the rise. But increasingly, there are other kinds of costs that are coming to light. Smoke exposure, for example, causes premature births, hospitalizations, and it reduces labor productivity. But there are also huge costs of things like buying masks and filters and power outages, recreational losses, increased utility rates from liability rules. And when you add up all these costs, they're really enormous. They're in the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars per year in the Western U.S. alone. But here's the key point. Measuring these costs is one thing, but finding actionable solutions, things we can actually direct increased finance to do, that's a whole different thing. So where do we go from here? You know, in my view and in my kind of reading of the economics literature and research, I think first we need to invest in the solutions we already know have a big impact. These are things like home hardening, insurance market reforms, forest management, which includes letting some fires burn, thinning forests, and things like that. Second, we need to rethink what I think of as the incentives around fire. How can we change incentives so governments, communities, even insurance companies have a financial interest in prevention and not just picking up the pieces after a big fire? Finally, I think targeted forest management is going to dramatically improve our chances of success per dollar spent. That is our return on investment. The forest estate is enormous. It's so huge that we just can't do it all. And the stakes are too high and resources are too scarce. So investing in more targeted and dynamic forest management, I think, will dramatically improve our chances of success. So to sum it up, I guess from an economic perspective, the scale of the problem is huge and it's growing. It's not just structure damage and suppression that's costly, it's health effects and other kinds of highly economically consequential effects. And we should set our sights on investing in proven high-impact solutions, realigning incentives for prevention over control, and investing in more targeted and dynamic forest management.
That was Chris Costello from University of California, Santa Barbara. There are too many costs to these super wildfire seasons. Rivers and fish are damaged. Hillsides bare of forest roots slide into valleys and cities. Lungs and humans and wildlife collect soot. So many ways of harm. And over all of those is the new burden of carbon released from those trunks and branches in the fire. Wildfire smoke may provide cooling for a little while, but added carbon stays up there like a heat blanket for 100,000 years. New forests cannot grow back fast enough to avoid possible tipping points. In a new climate, they may not grow back at all. Just the cost of carbon released by Canadian wildfires in 2023 is beyond estimation. That carbon burden will show up in warmer seas, bigger storms, in drought for some, super rain for others, and heat, heat, heat. How do we measure those costs spread over a planet and spread over time? You can download this program free at ecoshock.org. Get bonus notes with all the links to the science and videos in my show blog. It's published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. As climate accelerates, our minds become full. Let us decelerate as the artificial band strikes up climate songs like the music of the spheres. Thank you for listening.
They stress for the money, no time to be outside
the system.
We make sure there is no time to be outside
the system.
Everything I know, I learned on TV, TikTok or YouTube, by my
system.
We make sure there is no time to be outside
the system.
Everyone off the grid dies in the heat. Everyone on the grid better do what you are told. We decide if you get to be old.
The system.
You can fight, but you can't win in the system you're in.
The system. The system.
Smoke, no stars aligned. Does dust clouds choke skies, no more blue. Climate killing headlines, you know they're true. Fast fury rushing on a dead end. Gasoline disease. Oh, 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 oh. Ash rains down, yeah, melts my pride. Oh, oh, oh. Ocean waves swell, swallow the tide. Oh, oh. Red hot nights melt. Gasoline disease. Can't stop this car redlining the doom. The radio crackles impending boom. Feel the heat bite like a serpent divine. Wreckage in motion, clock out of time. Gasoline disease. Too late time. Too late. Planes full of sulfur, stall for time. Monsoon not known, climate cover blown. A brand new state, living in the lake. All along the line, desperate measures.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. To reduce their climate impact, many companies buy what are known as forest carbon credits. They're a way to offset the company's own carbon emissions by paying to plant or protect trees which absorb and store carbon as they grow. The organizations that certify these credits have protocols they use to estimate a project's impact.
One credit should represent 1 ton of additional carbon dioxide that is stored in a forest.
But Rebecca Sanders-DeMott of the Clean Air Task Force says many projects fail to live up to that promise because of flaws in the protocols. In a recent analysis, her team found, for example, that many certification programs underestimate the risk of wildfire or disease, which can kill trees, or they don't adequately account for the possibility that protecting trees in one area could increase logging in another.
But the good news is we do think the system is fixable.
She says incorporating new scientific tools and data can help researchers better predict the risk trees face in a particular region and improve project monitoring over time.
We can make sure that these credits actually protect and enhance forest carbon storage, but only if the system is strong and rooted in science.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. Simon Fraser University Campus Radio. Streaming on the internet at www.cjsf.ca.